Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to Ethics Talk. The team, that would be myself and Dr. Hope May, is delighted to be joined tonight by Pratik and Samik, who founded the RSO Universities Allied for Essential Medicine CMU chapter. You didn't found the chapter.
No.
Who founded the chapter? See, we're off on the wrong foot. Now we're going to start
Stephen
over.
Stephen Witte, he was a student at Central Michigan University.
Yeah, okay.
He actually did found that. We were the founding members.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
we didn't.
You know, same difference.
Yeah.
They're on the internet. They don't know the difference. Anyway, they're going to tell us all about their organization, what they're interested in, and their core values. So, tell me, what is UAEM? Open question. Explain it to me.
Well, the acronym UAEM stands for Universities Allied for Essential Medicines. To describe what UAEM is, we have to go to the history, sort of, because it all started with a campaign in 2001, and that started with success, actually, with the campaign. So a group of Yale University law students, together with Doctors Without Borders, they started this campaign to convince the Yale University and the pharmaceutical company Bristol Myers Squibb to sublicense one of the drugs that was developed at Yale University.
Sublicense?
Okay, so there was a drug called D4T or Stavdine, and antiretroviral drug for HIV/AIDS discovered at Yale University. So whenever an investigator discovers a drug, they're going to license that drug to a pharmaceutical company because you can only do so much at your research university. I mean, the pharmaceutical companies have big money, so they conduct clinical trials, which is really important to further the innovation.
Mm-hmm.
So they licensed it to Bristol Myers Squibb. They did further research and finally made the drug available in the market. But what happened was BMS, Bristol Myers Squibb, they set the price at $1,600 per person per year, which was reasonable for people who could afford it. But if you think about one-third of the world's population living in less than a dollar per day or a few dollars per day and being affected by HIV/AIDS, they couldn't afford it. So that's why the students at Yale University, with collaboration with Doctors Without Borders and Partners in Health, they convinced Yale University and the pharmaceutical company to sublicense it to a generic company to produce a generic version of the drug at the developing countries so that they could be produced in those countries and exclusively sold in those countries at an affordable price for those people.
So a sublicense is like a more restrictive or very narrow patent or license, or it's earmarked for, so you have this general use. Go ahead. I'm trying to understand what it is.
So, so again, going back to the story, what happened was Doctors Without Borders was really frustrated because most of these patients, HIV/AIDS patients, were in poor countries. And simply because they didn't have enough money to buy these drugs,
mm-hmm.
So they went to Yale University and asked if they could do anything. Yale University said we don't have any rights; all the rights are given
mm-hmm.
to Bristol Myers Squibb. And
mm-hmm.
they went to Bristol Myers Squibb, and they are being an ideal business. They just declined the offer; they wouldn't
mm-hmm.
lower down the price. And so one of the student activists at Yale. What she did was she got a hold of Dr. Prusov, who actually discovered this drug at Yale. And he was furious. He was really angry and wrote an op-ed on New York Times, and which gave tremendous pressure to Bristol Myers Squibb. And so after that, what happened, the deal was Bristol Myers Squibb would continue making the drug at whatever price they are selling at for people who can afford it. But at the same time, generic companies could take the data,
the patent.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
the patent, and produce these for people in developing countries.
Okay.
So,
but the generic drug companies couldn't produce this for people in the United States?
No.
No.
Okay, gotcha.
So split up by geographic market, basically?
Mm-hmm. Pretty much.
Okay.
And the result was the price was reduced by 96% in a year. For people in developing countries. So that was a huge success, and that's where UAEM started.
And it was, I mean, then people thought, well, the students and the activists thought, well, rather than fighting every drug at a time or every medical innovation at a time, why not just start at the root of the problem, you know, just include something, some policies at the universities and their technology transfer policies so that every health-related technology or biomedical research, the outcome of biomedical research could be licensed in this way, you know, something we call global access-friendly policies. So that's where UAM actually started. So people thought, well, let's just get together and find out universities that do a tremendous amount of research, and mind you, it's through taxpayers' dollars. You know, it's publicly funded universities do these research, and in the end, what happens is the pharmaceutical companies get all the monopoly they want, and we thought this is not right.
Yale's not public, though.
It is not, but it gets most of the NIH and NSF public money.
Okay.
So
it gets federal money.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Billions of dollars that
mm-hmm.
NIH gives out to
mm-hmm.
various research
right.
institutions and universities.
So has Yale adopted a policy such as this, where any drug they discover is given a global access policy from the start? That's what you're saying, right, that when the university discovers a drug, automatically generic companies will be allowed to produce it for third world countries, something like this?
So what happened was, since then, since 2001, UAM came up with various versions of its global access licensing policy
right.
That it promoted. And the main one right now, the most advanced one right now we are promoting is, it's called Global Access Licensing Framework, GALF. And what the general notion of universities was, it was too restrictive, too strict, and like they were totally resistant to those clauses that we put forward. So what these universities did was, they actually, Autumn Association of University Technology Managers, it's an umbrella organization of the of most of the university's technology transfer officers. So they met and they came up with something called SBS, Statements of Principles and
Strategies.
So Yale University has signed on to it, along with Harvard, Brown, and a couple other big names. But in reality,
the SBS is basically a watered-down version of GALF.
Yeah.
I mean, it does have really good clauses, but it's a stepping stone to where we want to get. So, I mean, Yale has adopted those policies, signed on to those policies, but it still has ways to go.
Yeah.
And
it
same with
not,
other universities.
Yale has not significantly shown the commitment, the whatever they signed on to it. So it's not... it's there in theory, they sign on to it, but in practice, it's not.
So what were some of the opportunities that they should have taken but did not? Yale, for instance, which makes you come to this conclusion?
So as part of, okay, so it's a whole...
I know.
Yeah, complicated thing. But what we do is, as part of UAM's, we have a working group called Metrics. And what it does is it sends out surveys to all these TTOs, technology transfer officers, every year. And based on their answers, they ask questions like, did you, when you were licensing these, selling these patents to these pharmaceuticals or these highest bidder, did you put this language forward? Did you ask them that they will need to allow these generics to produce these products for people in the poor world? So those kinds of questions are asked, and based on their answers, so it's basically seeing how much the TTOs are taking this issue seriously, if they are bargaining with these pharmaceuticals or high bidders or not. So Harvard has shown significant improvement, and we do have, UAM has 6-month follow-up meetings with Harvard TTO, but Yale is not there yet.
Okay.
On the way.
So what sorts of people are members of UAEM? Is it exclusively a student organization? I heard you mentioning like a subdivision or something like that, so I'm guessing not, but can you explain to me the hierarchy of power?
So, yeah, sure. So we are basically an international nonprofit organization, and our main working force is students. So it is one of our mission values, mission statement as well, to empower students so as to get these licensing policies in the university and get students a part of this advocacy and part of the solution.
Basically, respond to these crises, these access crises or problems, the global problems like the healthcare problem.
Yeah, and because we are focusing universities at this point, so and again, students are the leaders of tomorrow. So like. Basically, the working force, major working force is students, but we have a couple of paid staff as well. But majorly, it's totally voluntary.
I mean, students of medicine, public health.
Law schools.
Law students, economics, and various other areas. You know.
So are you familiar with the term NGO, non-governmental? No. Would you say that you're an NGO?
You're an 501.
But we're private, non-profit organization.
Okay. Yeah. A charitable private non-profit.
Right.
Got it.
Yep.
Okay. Perhaps a 501c3, which we'll be discussing on Sunday. Okay, so tell me, you've already filled me in that you are not the founding members. I apologize for my mistake.
Uh-huh.
How did you become involved with the CMU chapter?
Sure.
Well, Steve Witte, he went to one of the UM has annual conferences every year. So Steve went to one of the conferences at UC Berkeley. He was the only one who went. I mean, and then when he came back with like so much enthusiasm and then so much energy. And then he was completely blown away by the idea that student leadership was so important and an issue as important as this. I mean, we didn't even know that issues like these existed. We knew that there was disparity with regard to healthcare, coming from a developing country like Nepal, we knew that there was massive disparities, social injustice, but we didn't know what kinds of approaches there were being taken or any solutions, any potential solutions to these problems. So when Steve came back from the conference, he was a friend of ours, and Pratik, me, Steve, and a couple other friends sat down and said, well, let's start a chapter here. It was Steve's idea, and so we just started a chapter. It sounded very exciting, the idea that student leadership could play such an important role.
Do you know how he found out about this conference at Berkeley?
I know he was looking into something to be involved with. I mean, he was also passionate about getting into social justice and the whole process. And, like, I think he was just... Googling something.
You can't be sure.
Google is always the answer to everything.
Yeah. I mean,
you should have known.
Has it been everything you hoped for?
Yeah.
More. More than
that.
Good answer. So Hope asked you, sorry for just sort of derailing the train here, but these questions are just coming to me. Hope asked you what Yale passed on, what Yale should have done better. So I take it the essential medicines portion of the Ackerman is things like, as you described, AIDS medicine, things like this.
Mm-hmm.
What other medicines has UAEM targeted?
Well, essential medicines are basically, you know, turns out that World Health Organization actually defines essential medicines as the drugs and vaccines that are necessary for any basic healthcare system. And they include drugs or vaccines for many neglected diseases and diseases like HIV/AIDS, tuberculosis, malaria, and also actually non-communicable diseases like diabetes. I think some cancer and cardiovascular diseases are also essential. I'm not sure about cancer, but
Now, are generic versions already available in third world countries of those sorts of drugs? Like, I'm imagining like the MMR vaccine. Is that already available as a generic? I'm kind of sad to say I don't know.
MMR, I'm not certain about the vaccines, but for drugs like HIV/AIDS, obviously there are generic versions available. For malaria, I know generic versions are available. And
from our personal experience, it was available for really cheap.
That's why it should have been, because we were all vaccinated. We were born in Nepal, and we're vaccinated at a very low cost. So we're kind of imagining that it must have been available. Those vaccines must have been available.
Those aren't problem vaccinations, is what you're saying. They're readily available.
Right? Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
But then there are a lot of other neglected diseases that we are talking about right now,
mm-hmm.
and mostly when we talk about access to medicine problem, the neglected tropical diseases, which majorly affects sub-Saharan region, major parts of Africa, Asia, and South America. And it's not because the drug is not available. It is available. Most of them are available, and it's, most of the diseases are preventable and treatable, but it's just these patients cannot afford a couple of cents to buy these drugs, and that's why they are there to die. And in some of the cases, pharmaceuticals, and of course, pharmaceutical companies don't have any incentives to do more research into it to make like better versions of these medicines. So most of these medicines which are available are the ones with high levels of side effects. So lots of research has to be done, but which is not there, and that's what we advocate for.
So basically, the essential medicines, basically drugs and vaccines, they're either unavailable because there is not much research and development done for these because of the lack of profit incentive, or unaffordable, or just inappropriate,
mm-hmm.
you know. So for human use, at least. So 1/3 of the world's population are actually being affected by one or more of these preventable, mind you, and treatable diseases, and they're neglected because as the health technologies were developed and developed more and more, the rich countries and the basically global north, if you want to put it, benefited from it tremendously. The life expectancy, it's said that it raised by 4 months every year or so, but the majority of the people, 2 billion people or more in these poor countries, they didn't benefit from this technology.
Right.
You know, so and consequently, people in the rich countries forgot about these diseases because they most of these diseases thrive in impoverished conditions.
And here we are talking about diseases like leprosy, which a lot of Americans just read in Bible and and they don't even know that these diseases still exist in some parts of the world. And
you put an extra little accent on preventable diseases. Can you distinguish for me a preventable disease from a non-preventable disease?
Basically, so many parasitic-born diseases and diseases that are transmitted from water, you know, impure water, or through soil, they could be prevented. It's absurd to think that it could be prevented as from as little as wearing slippers, flip-flops, basically. I mean, these are like ridiculously preventable, if you want to put it that way. I mean, we even run a campaign called we're talking about it, like the Just 50 Cents campaign, where you could buy seven drugs for seven neglected diseases for just 50 cents for one person per year. I mean, it's preventable to that extent, you know.
And again, what's the website if people are interested in doing that?
The website of the 50 Cents or UAM?
50 cents. You guys were talking about it before.
Globalnetwork.org.
Globalnetwork.org.
Just 50 cents. 50 cents.
Just Google it.
If you just 50 cents, it'll come up.
Like the rapper. and you were saying as far as being ridiculously preventable, it could be something as simple as boiling water or wearing slippers.
Absolutely.
So, sorry for sidetracking you yet again, but what would a day look like if I were you, if I wanted to be a member of UAEM? What would we do at our meeting?
It happens to be we have a meeting tonight, actually, so you're going to join us. So anyway, we basically...
Are they listening?
I hope so.
Yeah, I believe.
Have a fun meeting.
Yeah. So basically, we have many projects going on. At any given time, we've had, I don't know, what, 5-6 different projects going on, some national, some international. It all depends. So basically, it depends on how active you want to be again.
Right.
See, there are some members who want to focus on some local issues and just do some fundraisers or do some socials and things like that. But there are many members, majority of our members, who are very interested in taking part in these national and international issues. Like we were doing this recent campaign to help pass the Canadian Senate this legislation called C.
Members of the Parliament.
Members
not
of the Parliament.
Senate. Yeah.
Sorry, Canadian. I forgot. the bill C.
Bill C-93.
Yeah, there we go. I forget the name. Anyway, so...
That bill.
That bill.
There we go.
Right.
We should do what you do. So it could include... I mean, it could involve anywhere from calling your representative at Senate at this... I mean, when we're talking about Bill C-939, it's just writing letters, basically signing an online petition. It's a click away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it goes back to what he said. So UWAIM deals with so many issues. So issues can be at local level, approaching your own technology transfer officers at your own university, or just making people aware of these diseases, aware of these problems. That can be local. Some of the national campaigns that we are doing, I don't even want to get into that. There are like so many different campaigns.
Mm-hmm.
And international projects such as there's a trade agreement between EU and India that we strongly oppose that will hamper the productions of these generic medicines in India. And India happens to be one of the largest suppliers of generic medicines in the world. So some of those issues, and there are a whole bunch of issues. So like it depending on the student's interest and time. So there can be any and everything.
Go ahead.
I was going to ask, how many students do you have as members here at CMU?
Probably anywhere between 20 to 25 active members. We do have a pretty big listserv, but between 20 to 25 active members,
yeah, right.
I would say. And they're very active. They're very passionate about these things.
Mm-hmm.
And they plan on medical school or law school, or not necessarily?
No.
Okay.
Like I mentioned, I mean, it's a... Global health is such a big topic, and you need a multidisciplinary approach.
Right.
So we have students from physical science or sociology. Obviously, we have more students, the pre-med students, but that's not just the case. We had
anthropology.
There are some students who want to go into public health.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Health policy, health administration. So,
It sounds like, correct me if I'm wrong, but the way you're describing it, you're as much a sort of launch pad for people who want to fix these sorts of things as anything else. Like you've got your cookies in so many jars, like eggs in so many baskets, whatever.
Right.
Yes. I mean, that's true. I mean, it, like I said again, I mean, it depends on how active you want to be and what part of the problem you want to focus on, or what parts of the problems you want to focus
and
on.
How much interest and how much time you have. Again, going back to my own example, we started this chapter in 2008, November 2008, from Stephen Woody's
initiation.
And after a year, I felt like I was prepared to do more, so I joined the national team. So I'm part of, since 2009, September of 2009, I've been serving the UAIM's National International Coordinating Committee, and I'm serving as the International Chapter Outreach Coordinator. So, and my specific focus is developing countries right now. And so after that, I did a lot of work. So like, depending on how much you're interested and how much time.
Yeah, helping chapters set up in other countries, like we started that. With our help, Nigeria and Nepal started a local chapter of UAIM in those countries. So he does a lot of work in that. I do a lot of work locally. So, I mean,
what are some local projects?
Well, the conference is one of our biggest local projects. We've been planning it for a year now. We'll probably talk about the conference in a while. But we do fundraisers, like I mentioned, Justice Defense Campaign. It was a pretty good success last year, and we bring in speakers all the time, you know, like all the time being every 2 or 3 months we at least try to bring one speaker or two speakers. And in this case, the conference, we're bringing like 15 or more speakers.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and other than that, we are also approaching the university to Central Michigan University to sign on to one of these global access licensing policies. That's been going on since 2008.
Mm-hmm.
And things are going.
Yeah, we just presented to the, I did a presentation with to the officials at ORSB, Office of Research and Sponsored Programs. That is our technology transfer office at CMU. And they were very receptive about it. And now, hopefully, we get to present to the president and the board of directors to officially sign on to these policies.
And apart from that, the new medical school is starting in 2013, as you guys know. So we've been part of the team and where they're incorporating global health into their MD curriculum. So we are...
To prepare the future doctors with this, to give them information and resources about these problems, you know, just making them aware about these things from the beginning.
So if I was one of those students with nothing but energy and nowhere to put it and wanted to change the world, you could point me in the right direction?
Absolutely.
Yep.
Okay, you heard it here first. UAEM, gateway to good things. You're listening to Pratik and Samik talk about, I guess, their involvement in this international organization. If you'd like to call in, you have a question for them, we welcome you to. It's 1-646-727-3928. If we don't get to you right away, just hold on. I'll get you off the switchboard eventually. So I might be jumping ahead of myself. You were talking about this conference. Let's have it. What's this conference?
All right. So like I said, we've been planning it for probably over a year now. the title of the conference is Improving Global and Domestic Healthcare Disparities, a Collaboration Across Disciplines. It's quite a mouthful.
Yeah, I didn't catch all that. That's okay.
Yeah, it's very catchy. Anyway, so I have to look at a paper to say the title of it.
Can you say it again?
Improving Global and Domestic Healthcare Disparities, a Collaboration Across Disciplines.
Okay.
I am reading off of the paper. So basically, we wanted to raise awareness in the CMU campus and Mount Pleasant community.
And in the Midwest region.
And in the Midwest region to... about these problems, about global health disparities, about also some local healthcare disparities. We're including Native American healthcare disparities because oftentimes we forget that we have problems in our own backyard.
Right.
So we wanted to give a little bit of a taste, if you will, about the local healthcare disparities. And it's very relevant to talk about Native American healthcare disparities since we're in...
surrounded by reservations.
Yep.
Yeah.
So, like we talked, there global health is a really big problem, and there's not just one solution to it. There's people from all different areas, people with all different ideas have to come together to pose a solution, potential solution to this problem, and it is an ongoing process. So we wanted CMU and the students at CMU, faculty, administrators, to have an idea about what the problems are, what it takes to tackle some of these problems, what are the potential resources that we might have in our hands at CMU, or some collaborations that we could do with other universities or other institutions to tackle some of these problems.
Yeah. And generally, when we talk about these issues, general notion of general people is that, these people have problems, let's just send them $10, I'll donate $10, or I'll send you money, or I'll send, we can send medicines or nets, malaria, mosquito nets.
Which is important, which is very important.
Those are important too, but other than that, there's so much to do that a person can do, even if they don't have money to donate. So that's what we want to bring in and educate the campus community.
It's about empowering students or empowering individuals with the right information. So we think that's very important to actually get to the root of the problem. You have to know what the problem is.
Right.
And we hope that this conference will bring in those problems and different perspectives to the solution or even to the problem. So...
And who better to put pressure on universities and or drug companies than a bunch of college students with time to kill,
precisely.
Right?
Precisely.
I like it. You sold me. Moving back perhaps in the wrong direction a little bit, you're talking about working with Central to try and get us to incorporate one of these global health policies, I think you called it. Is that right?
Global Access License.
I'm sorry. Okay. GELF, right.
Yes.
What drugs has Central developed? I mean, have we come up with anything that's going to change the world?
Okay. So we understand Central Michigan University is not a research-oriented,
right.
research-focused
not
university.
Yet.
Not yet.
Yeah, I think some people would disagree with that.
I mean, there's a substantial amount of research, but so far...
It's not a big player in
right.
big
sure.
drug discovery or anything like that, but that doesn't mean that we develop a drug and then go after it, you know?
Right.
That's exactly how we started at Yale University, mm-hmm. and that's exactly why we formed UAIM, to go to the root of the problem before even it begins, you know? Mm-hmm. Say, I mean, in the 10 or 20 years down the road with the new medical school and, I don't know, law school, whatever... If the university would have massive potentials
mm-hmm.
to attract biomedical researchers and whatnot. So we want to get these policies in beforehand.
Yeah.
I mean, this is not a scary thing. That's one thing you need to realize. It's not like you're going to scare away potential investors or anything
mm-hmm.
like that. Actually, turns out there are potential investors like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation
sure.
with billions of dollars to donate to specific causes like these, and
yeah.
universities and institutions
yeah.
who have adopted these
yeah.
policies, I mean, they have huge advantage in getting these grants. So you're not scaring away anybody. You're actually doing a good thing, and it's about doing the right thing. You know, I mean, talk about social responsibility and moral values. You're a publicly funded institution, and one of your mission statements is, you know, we'll promote, I don't know, education, research,
public
service. Where's the public service part? Mm-hmm. And you don't say American public service or European public service. You say public service.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to look at this from a fundamental human being perspective.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what does it take to get a treatment? Does it take to be, do you have to be of a certain nationality, even if you're dying from a ridiculously preventable disease?
Right.
I mean,
so to be precise, right now we don't have such a big discovery, but
in case we get one,
medical school is starting soon, and we know for sure biomedical sciences PhD program will happen someday, and we already have Science of Advanced Materials doctoral program up and running. So there is huge potential that CME can come up with major discoveries.
Absolutely.
It's a very good sales pitch. I can tell you've been polishing up in the mirror.
I have a question.
Go ahead.
If I may. I mean, since you threw in the social justice term, so going back to this original drug, the HIV drug that was developed at Yale, and you said the original price point was $1,600 per year, which was reasonable for people in the United States. So I'm sure you guys know about the new healthcare legislation, and not everybody, even in the United States, can afford that, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so there's an interesting moral question, right? So what about the people in the market that, because of their geographical location, right? Because it's really, you know, a sort of geographical lottery going on. Because of where you're born, that determines the kind of access that you have. And it's not the case that if you're born in the United States, that you're going to have access, because actually it's a disadvantage to you to be here because you're not privy to the sub-license. I just wanted to see what you're... I'm sorry to resist, but there's an interesting question about social justice here,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah, and getting on to that question, and there are, again, so our UAIM's main focus is access to essential medicines worldwide,
mm-hmm.
regardless of anyone's financial status.
Mm-hmm.
So the situation is most of the disparities, when we see it surfacely, most of the disparities are in the poor nations.
Right.
But we do understand there are so many disparities, so many problems here as well.
Mm-hmm.
And we do a lot of campaigns here
mm-hmm.
in the United States as well. And some of the examples.
Well,
one of the recent example that we are getting into is so apparently FDA there's this shot, progesterone shot
mm-hmm.
that moms take in order to prevent premature birth. And it used to be, the situation was, you used to get it, anyone could get it for $10 a shot. And there were, the thing was, it was available in generic forms as well. But recently, FDA licensed, gave full monopoly of this.
Exclusive license
to a pharmaceutical company called KV Pharmaceuticals. And as soon as they got it, they announced that the shot, the price for per shot will be $1,500.
Yeah, this just came out in the media because, you know, the funny thing is all the upfront research and everything was done at NIH, which is a publicly funded. I mean, your money and you know, the taxpayers' money. By using those taxpayers' money, the initial research was done at NIH. But what happened was by gaining these exclusive rights, KV Pharmaceuticals has exclusive monopoly. They can set the price, I mean, in this case, from $10 to $1,500 per dose. Yeah. So what this means is that, I'm just going to tell you something, a couple of numbers, actually. So if all the women who are eligible for this drug got treated at this new price, that would add about $3.9 to $4.2 billion to healthcare for one drug. I mean, if you're wondering about the math, the original cost, if it was still there, would have cost about $26 to $28 million. So, I mean, that's an issue we're actually focusing on. I mean, UME is probably going to issue
one of the many examples.
I mean, these things happen all the time. Like,
yeah,
the thing with biologics, I mean, I don't know how familiar you are with biologics legislation. I mean, biologics are these new kinds of drugs. Mm-hmm. Like, they're not your ordinary drug. They're made in living systems, basically.
Yeah,
living cells. So they're different from aspirin or any other drug that you buy in the market, but they are supposed to take probably 50, I mean half of the 100 top-selling drugs by 2014. And so this is getting into too much detail now. But
no, not at all.
Yeah.
But see, what pharmaceutical industries are trying to do is they're trying to pass this legislation for data exclusivity. So whenever you, a company or institution, they discover a drug, there's 5 years of data exclusivity for these small molecule drugs like aspirin or Tylenol or whatever. But they are trying to ask for 12 years of data exclusivity.
Mm-hmm.
So what their argument is that it takes too much money, too much effort to make these drugs, but research has shown that that's not the case. I mean, the Federal Trade Commission has even told them that even 5 years is too much for you guys, you know, and they're trying to ask for 7 more years. And there's another policy called, I think, evergreening, which would give them a way to keep getting that monopoly over and over again, basically stopping generic production.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They'll just make tiny change in the drug, and they will ask for more number of years.
Because it's not the same drug.
Yeah. I mean, it's ridiculous to think that pharmaceutical industry
We did campaigns on that, against that, and we are thinking of doing a campaign against this KV pharmaceutical.
So there's a lot of issues at home that we focus on.
Yeah, and there's only so much you can do, and there's so many problems everywhere, and there's only so much you can do. So I was just throwing it in there, and since we're, you know, in detail and doing philosophy and social justice still, in my view, it seems like, what's the pharmaceutical company that you're,
KV Pharmaceuticals.
KV Pharmaceuticals. And I have two questions. One is just sort of the story of, so you have NIH developing this progesterone.
Yep.
And then, why was it transferred to this pharmaceutical
company? Because they were the only ones who applied, probably.
Okay.
And it was issued to them.
I'm not sure if it was developed at NIH, but it was from NIH. And
right.
Money.
Okay, yeah. So this is my question, because this is, you know, raises really interesting philosophical, which become legal, you know, concepts.
Right.
But this idea of, there's a property interest involved in the drug. And, you know, the question is, who owns it and who has the right to it? And there seems to be this assumption that, okay, if the highest bidder puts up money, then they have the ownership for it. But you guys are saying, well, this part of it, at least, that there's some effort. This is actually called the Lockean theory of property, where, you know, some effort is put into the creation of it, therefore the public also has a right to it.
Oh, yeah.
But it sounds like you're criticizing KV Pharmaceuticals for doing the wrong thing.
Actually, there is an argument why the cost of medicine is high. So what they are doing is, so all of these $10 shots available were not studied properly. So part of the deal right now is KV has to run a lot of clinical trials and to make sure these don't have side effects and whatnot, all the clinical trials, they have to do it. And there will be significant amount of money spent on it.
Mm-hmm.
But when we calculate the whole thing, still $4.6 billion for one single drug is totally...
4.2. Yeah. But anyway, yeah. So it is understandable when a company invests amount of money. Like in this case, they're probably investing in the bureaucratic stuff and to conduct clinical trials, which is very important, you know, to maintain the quality control and everything. I mean, but you have to imagine the price tag we're putting here, you know, $28 million versus $4.2 billion for one drug. I mean, there was this one of the UAMers who said this in one of our communications. Even if we're generous enough, I mean, and give them a ridiculous amount, like, say, $1 billion for all the investment that they put in, he says that they would recoup their entire investment in 1 year, even if, like, a quarter of the women eligible for the drug would use it. Like, in a year, you know, like, one-fourth of the women, if they use this shot, they would be able to recoup their entire cost. It's not like they did the, like, basic R&D, research and development for a drug, cost a tremendous amount of money, and it takes a very long time to develop.
Mm-hmm.
And that was done by taxpayers' money.
Mm-hmm.
By the way, getting into more detail about this particular case, what happened was NIH's money was used for the initial clinical trials as well. So drug was developed using taxpayers' money, and these clinical trials were also done using taxpayers' money, and then these pharmaceutical company comes in and applies for whatnot, and they get excessive monopoly, and they hike the price by 150-fold. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's been a lot of resistances, and some of the senators from Ohio wrote a couple of letters right away to reduce the price of the drug, and there's been a lot of public pressure going on, but we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
It may go anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So do you guys disagree about this issue?
As in it's wrong, that what they're doing?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yes. You wouldn't be here if you didn't.
Okay.
I'm torn. You know, the capitalist in me says, well, you know, if a medical company spends their, of course, you know, taxpayer dollars, different, you know,
right.
Fight altogether. But the capitalist in me says if a company invests millions of dollars, you know, in developing a drug, they should be able to put a price tag on it, whatever they want. But you did provide a very compelling argument saying, well, like Yale, for example, GELF doesn't hurt them in any way. It's not a market that, or rather pharmaceutical companies that have taken the rights from Yale, I should say.
And
go ahead.
Adding one more point. So after the whole D4T Stavidin story in 2001, the success story of UAIM, after that, Yale's public health dean openly said the license, the deal that they made, didn't affect Yale's financial gain at all. So it did not affect
sublicensing
the
patent to a generic company. It didn't, you know, affect the sales of the company or even anything.
It didn't affect Yale's
bottom line.
Items. Yeah.
But maybe there was somebody who didn't give because they saw what Yale was doing. Just kidding.
But essentially, you're saying there's no competition in the markets that we're allowing generic drugs in. There's no market there now. It's simply non-existent, and it's a needed drug that's not being provided.
For what? For anything or?
Let's go with the AIDS medication, for example.
Well, now there are.
Yeah,
there are generic.
There are generic versions of the drug. That's why the price
right.
has gone down like 50-fold, more than 50-fold.
Yeah,
I mean, it's. I think it's sold in less than $6 in the developing world
right now. Yeah, per person per year. And I mean, there are a lot of generic medicines, which India, Brazil, and South Africa, and Thailand, a couple of those countries, majorly produce. But right now, part of our fight is also in these countries where these generic production of generic drugs happens. These pharmaceuticals have got their foot in there, and they're trying to pass some laws that would seriously hinder these production. So, as I mentioned, the
generic production is a very interesting topic, because I think it was the Hatch-Waxman bill that was passed in 1984. I'm not sure on the date, but anyway, that year
that bill
was passed, and I mean, they said that they said that generic production would save the U.S. Economy, I think $1 billion for the next decade or something when they actually try to pass it. But it comes out now, it's like $734 billion in the last decade it saved us. I mean, generic, you have to understand the power of the competition that the generic pharmaceutical industry produce.
Mm-hmm.
It's tremendous.
This is a different topic. It's related to healthcare, but it seems like drugs, you know, this whole idea, essential medicines, right, that healthcare product is different than other products, and pharmaceutical companies perhaps are different than Nike or something like this. And this argument has been made. I don't know if you guys are aware about the opposition to at least definite, not to the whole healthcare bill, sometimes referred to as Obamacare. I hate when they use that. But a provision that actually forces people to buy health insurance. And this provision of the healthcare bill has been argued and successfully in some federal circuits as being unconstitutional, mm-hmm. because the government is forcing you to buy something, and there is no precedent in the United States jurisprudence for the federal government forcing you to buy something. And so people who make this argument try to remove the distinction, right? They want to make essential medicines. They want to blur this distinction between healthcare and Twinkies and so forth. And they use, you know, Twinkies in their example. So I was wondering if you guys, AIM ever talk about what's going on with the healthcare bill? And I could just say yes or no, and then I'll move on to my next question.
We didn't have, unanimous support mm-hmm. or opposition towards the whole
mm-hmm.
bill.
Mm-hmm.
What we looked into is some of the clause that was inside the bill as a whole
mm-hmm.
that we had problems with.
Mm-hmm.
So the problems, the things like biologics,
mm-hmm.
the data exclusivity.
Which, by the way, I think the bill
yeah.
actually is it's good for. The healthcare bill is good for, with the biologics.
Right.
They actually don't want to give that much data exclusivity.
Right.
I mean, we look at, like, things like that. I don't know. I mean, there might be some folks in the EM. I don't know. We have, like, what, more than 80 chapters all
yeah.
around the world, and there are tons of chapters in the U.S., and there might be some people who are actually working on, like,
mm-hmm.
looking at minute details of the
mm-hmm.
healthcare plan, but not that I know of.
Yeah.
I mean, we look at things like these different legislation,
okay.
yeah.
biologics and things like that. So.
All right. And my second question is, what is your own view on this provision of the bill? I mean, do you see health insurance as something like a different commodity than other sorts of things? I mean, the government doesn't force us to buy food, yet food is necessary.
Mm.
Yeah. I can't give an expert opinion on that, but
I'm just asking your personal opinion.
My personal opinion that the healthcare system is obviously broken
mm.
and needs
right.
to be fixed. I don't know about the government making us buy stuff, but if it leads to a better healthcare system,
mm.
why can't we do that? I mean, why does everything have to be compared with everything else? You know, why can't
mm.
we take case
yeah.
by case basis?
Mm-hmm.
It's for everybody. I mean, there might be, again, pros and cons to that, which I don't know, but
mm-hmm.
I'm just saying it's obviously broken. Like, think about
mm.
how many people declare bankruptcy because they can't
yeah.
afford healthcare.
There was a data I read last week. So So 62% of personal bankruptcies that are being filed are related to healthcare expenses. Hmm. So that's a ridiculous, statistically, that's a ridiculous number. And also, like, if you look at the world perspective, United States spends the most amount of money per person per year, and yet it falls in, like, 28 or something in the healthcare ranking in the world. So, like, the system is...
It's obviously broke. I mean, you have to think about... I personally think that the health administration costs and things like that, like, I think it spends, like, 25% of the total healthcare budget in administrative costs, where a country like Taiwan, they spend, like, 5%,
right.
You know? I mean, things like that, I mean, I think this bill addresses, like, a lot of those issues. And, I don't know all the pros and cons, but things like those need to be fixed.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and actually, this is like a scalpel. Like, some people are just trying to take a scalpel instead of, people always use this metaphor, scalpel versus a meat axe.
Right.
So instead of just throwing away the whole bill, they're focused on this one specific provision.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's interesting because this idea of essential medicines and also the people who are supporting the bill presume that insurance and medicine are essential. So it could be the case that the whole bill, you know, is okay. And what some people may argue is actually this is like, you know, a cancer. And, you know, if like we let the principle of this actually come into the jurisprudence of this country or the government, because you know, this country, here I'm just giving you the argument, is rooted in this tradition of the government giving us some degree of liberty, right? And if we start to allow this, you know, we're getting into a territory which eventually down the road will do more harm than good. That's what some people argue. So your assumption is, you know, the whole healthcare bill will improve a broken system. And what I'm saying is somebody may argue that, well, if we let this little, like, cancer cell come in, like, actually it will wreak greater harm than we can imagine. I'm not saying it should. I'm just putting it out there. That's all I want to say about it.
Well, I absolutely agree. One of my roommates is actually in health administration. And I absolutely agree with your basic point that, look, you know, these dollars are simply not translating to quality of living, that we're spending all this money, and it's not clear that anything is, no good is coming of it, or not as much good as coming as should be. Sorry, I'm a little bit tongue-tied. But, yeah, I might be one of those little naysayers who says, look, you know, this is the cancer that's killing us. I don't know. Maybe not. Maybe that's another show.
Yeah, the healthcare would be like multiple shows, I think.
Yeah,
yep.
Or just these lawsuits, because what's so interesting is that these are being filed in federal court, and you know it's a constitutional argument, and you have federal circuits are disagreeing with the interpretation, which they will do.
It's going to happen.
So, but I think at root is this deep philosophical question about the nature of government and what its function is.
Sure.
And before, we've talked about, they're called first-generation versus second-generation rights, where first-generation rights are like your political civil liberties, where they impose what's called like a negative duty on the government to not interfere. Right? And so this is like sort of the tradition of the United States, whereas the second-generation are like positive duties of the government to provide. And these second-generation rights typically come out of, you know, Europe and South America and so forth. And mm-hmm. so there's definitely a battle going on in this country, and who are people who are trying to prevent as much as they can these second-generation rights from transforming this country. So... Sorry.
That's okay. We have about 5 to 7 minutes left. We want to head in the finishing direction. So tell me, someone listening to our show right now is just inspired. They want to know more. What can they do?
First thing, I think they should come to our conference, which is being held at Central Michigan University on April 2nd and 3rd, the Saturday and Sunday. It's a full 2 days packed of exciting events and amazing speakers. Just to give you some names, the keynote is Mr. Stephen Lewis, the co-director of AIDS Free World. He's one of the biggest names in HIV/AIDS activism. He's coming from Canada. There are tons of other speakers that we've lined up. I mean, and again, like different speakers, like the name of the conference is, it's a collaboration amongst disciplines, across disciplines. I'm sorry, see, I can't even get it right. So anyway, so there are professors, there are doctors, there are student leaders.
Politicians, lawyers, anthropologists.
Perhaps even Dr.
Right.
Hope Mann.
Yeah. Human rights activist.
I might be filming it.
You're definitely there.
And we should say that, yes, if all goes well, even if you can't physically be here in Mount Pleasant, that if all goes well, you will be able to watch it online and even submit questions via chat and participate that way. And there's a website, correct?
Yes, the website, if you want to register for the conference, which is, by the way, open to all and free, it's uaem.cmich.edu, and there are links to the registration website and details on the speakers. Our whole agenda is there. So please do go to uaem.cmich.edu and do register. Again, to stress, it's free. And
but
we have,
need to register.
Yes. We do have like other events. Like we're screening a movie called Living in Emergency, Stories of Doctors Without Borders on Saturday. Should be interesting. We also have an advocacy training for students and student leaders or other individuals who are interested. Dan Gakin, the coordinator of Leadership Institute, will be giving that an advocacy training session. And again, there's an interesting session, actually. At the end of each day of conference, we have a brainstorming session. Like, when you go to these conferences, you are packed up with these amazing ideas, but you come home and forget. You know, so we didn't want that to happen, so we wanted to have a sort of a strategic planning session where we gather up these speakers, students, faculty, administrators from CMU, and by the way, I should mention there's people coming from other universities like Washington University in St. Louis. The students are coming from there.
A couple of universities in Canada.
University of Michigan. Yeah. Anyway, so those people will be in a room, and we will be discussing what are the potential resources we can explore at CMU to come up with solutions. Can we propose a curriculum or propose a course in global health or anything, you know, a collaboration between faculty and students?
Right. Interdisciplinary research groups and neglected tropical diseases, or as a whole, focus towards global health solutions of global and local healthcare disparities.
Right.
So, and one of our long-term goals is to establish something like public health school, global health and social justice school, and even law school at Central. So these discussions will probably give us some idea, and at least the minimum hope is to come up with
courses and curriculums and teams that will so tangible results, basically.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and also we mentioned like Native American Health Disparities Panel will be there as well, just to look at some local health disparities issues. So April 2nd and 3rd.
And going back to the video stream, that if all goes well, will be there. There will be an embedded video player at uaem.cmich.edu. So if you go there, the video will be right there on the front page.
And we have links to all this on our show resources, ethicstalk.cmich.edu. Check it out if you didn't get to write down the URL. As you said, April 2nd and 3rd, if you want to go to a conference discussing all these fascinating topics and be educated.
And I just want to say, you know, in closing, we were, you know, talking about websites and live. Well, with 90 seconds left, I just want to say that the way that we came into contact with each other was not through Google. So I want to, you know, just give it up for, like, real human contact. And we had a table in the library for Human Rights Month, and Pratik came up, and that's how we met, and that was last November. And so this is a result of that. Just wanted to end with that note. Sorry.
That's all right. Thank you so much for doing the show, Pratik and Samik. It's been very enlightening. Any closing thoughts?
Attend the conference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And join UAIM.
Right. And just to close the thought, it shouldn't be okay to die with a preventable disease as long as you're
Absolutely.
Poor. You know, that shouldn't be the case. And thank you for having us. It was wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Likewise. Thank you.
You've been listening to Ethics Talk. Have a great night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.